Unit 8.
Text 1. Appetite by Laurie Lee. One of the major pleasures in life is appetite, and one of our major duties should be to preserve it. Appetite is the keenness of living. It is one of the senses that tells you that you are still curious to exist, that you still have an edge on your longings, and want to bite into the world and taste its multitudinous flavors and juices. By appetite, of course, I don't mean just the lust for food, but any condition of unsatisfied desire, any burning in the blood that proves you want more than you've got, and that you haven't yet used up your life. Wilde said he felt sorry for those who never got their heart's desire, but sorrier still for those who did. I got mine once only, and it nearly killed me, and I've always preferred wanting to having since. For appetite, to me, is this state of wanting which keeps one's exceptions alive. I remember learning this lesson long ago as a child, when treats and orgies were few, and when I discovered that the greatest pitch of happiness was not in actually eating a toffee, but in gazing at it beforehand. True, the first bite was delicious, but once the toffee was gone, one was left with nothing, neither toffee nor lust. Besides, the whole toffiness of toffees was imperceptibly diminished by the gross act of having eaten it. No, the best was in wanting it, in sitting and looking at it, when one tasted an inexhaustible treasure house of flavours. So, for me, one of the keenest pleasures of appetite remains in the wanting, not the satisfaction. In wanting a peach, or a whiskey, or a particular texture or sound, or to be with a particular friend. For in this condition, of course, I know that the object of desire is always at its most flawlessly perfect. Which is why I would carry the preservation of appetite to the extent of deliberate fasting, simply because I think that appetite is too good to lose, too precious to be bludgeoned into insensibility by satiation or overdoing it. For that matter, I don't really want 3 square meals a day. I want 1 huge, delicious, orgiastic, table-groaning blowout, say, every 4 days, and then not to be too sure where the next one is coming from. A day of fasting is not for me just a puritanical device for denying oneself a pleasure, but rather a way of anticipating a rare moment of supreme indulgence. Fasting is an act of homage to the majesty of appetite. So I think we should arrange to give up our pleasures regularly, our food, our friends, our lovers, in order to preserve their intensity and the moment of coming back to them. For this is the moment that renews and refreshes both oneself and the thing one loves. Sailors and travellers enjoyed this once, and so did hunters, I suppose. Part of the weariness of modern life may be that we live too much on top of each other, and are entertained and fed too regularly. Once we were separated by hunger both from our food and families, and then we learned to value both. The men went off hunting, and the dogs went with them. The women and children waved goodbye. The cave was empty of men for days on end. Nobody ate or knew what to do. The women crouched by the fire, the wet smoke in their eyes. The children wailed. Everybody was hungry. Then, one night, there were shouts and the barking of dogs from the hills, and the men came back loaded with meat. This was the great reunion, and everybody gorged themselves silly, and appetite came into its own. The long-awaited meal became a feast to remember, and an almost sacred celebration of life. Now we go off to the office, and come home in the evenings to cheap chicken and frozen peas. Very nice, but too much of it, too easy and regular, served up without effort or wanting. We eat, we are lucky, our faces are shining with fat, but we don't know the pleasure of being hungry any more. Too much of anything, too much music, entertainment, happy snacks, or time spent with one's friends, creates a kind of impotence of living, by which one can no longer hear, or taste, or see, or love, or remember. Life is short and precious, and appetite is one of its guardians, and loss of appetite is a sort of death. So if we are to enjoy this short life, we should respect the divinity of appetite, and keep it eager and not too much blunted. It is a long time now since I knew that acute moment of bliss that comes from putting parched lips to a cup of cold water. The springs are still there to be enjoyed. All one needs is the original thirst.
Text 2. Wanting an Orange by Larry Woywode. Oh, those oranges arriving in the midst of the North Dakota winters of the 40s. The mere color of them, carried through the door in a net bag or a crate from out of the white winter landscape. Their appearance was enough to set my brother and me thinking that it might be about time to develop an illness, which was the surest way of receiving a steady supply of them. Mom, we think we're getting a cold. We? You mean you two want an orange? This was difficult for us to answer or dispute. The matter seemed moved beyond our mere wanting. If you want an orange, she would say, why don't you just ask for one? We want an orange. We, again, we want an orange. May we have an orange, please? That's the way you know I like you to ask for one. Now, why don't each of you ask for one in the same way, but separately? Mom, and so on. There was no depth of degradation that we wouldn't descend to in order to get one. If the oranges hadn't wended their way northward by Thanksgiving, they were sure to arrive before the Christmas season, stacked first in crates at the depot, filling that musty place where pews sat back to back with a springtime acidity as if the building had been rinsed with a renewing elixir that set it right for yet another year. Then the crates would appear at the local grocery store, often with the top slats pried back on a few of them, so that we were aware of a resinous smell of fresh wood in addition to the already orangey atmosphere that foretold the season more explicitly than any calendar. And in the broken open crates, as if burst by the power of the oranges themselves, one or two of the lovely spheres would lie free of the tissue they came wrapped in. Always purple tissue, as if that were the only color that could contain the populations of them in their nestled positions. The crates bore paper labels at one end, of an orange against a blue background, or of a blue goose against an orange background, signifying the colorful other world, unlike our wintry one, that these phenomena had arisen from. Each orange, stripped of its protective wrapping as vivid in your vision as a pebbled sun, encouraged you to picture a whole pyramid of them in a bowl on your dining room table, glowing in the light as if giving off the warmth that came through windows from the real winter sun. And all of them came stamped with a blue-purple name as foreign as the other world that you might imagine as their place of origin, so that on Christmas Day you would find yourself digging past everything else in your Christmas stocking as if tunneling down to the country of China in order to reach the rounded bulge at the tip of the toe, which meant that you had received a personal reminder of another state of existence, wholly separate from your own. The packed heft and texture finally of an orange in your hand, that is it. And the eruption of smell and the watery fireworks as a knife in the hand of someone skilled, like our mother, goes slicing through the skin so perfect for slicing. This gaseous spray can form a mist-like smoke, which can then be lit with a match to create actual fireworks if there is a chance to hide alone with a match, matches being forbidden, and the peel from one. Sputtery ignitions can also be produced by squeezing a peel near a candle. At least one candle is generally always going on at Christmas time, and the leftover peels are set on the stove top to scent the house. And the ingenious way in which oranges come packed into their globes, the green nib at the top, like a detonator, can be bitten off, as if disarming the orange in order to clear a place for you to sink a tooth under the peel. This is the best way to start. If you bite at the peel too much, your front teeth will feel scraped like dry bone, and your lips will begin to burn from the bitter oil. Better to sink a tooth into this greenish or creamy depression and then pick at that point with the nail of your thumb, removing a little piece of the peel at a time. Later, you might want to practice to see how large a piece you can remove intact. The peel can also be undone in one continuous ribbon, a feat which maybe your father is able to perform, so that after the orange is freed, looking yellowish, the peel rewound will stand in its original shape, although empty. The yellowish hull of the orange can now be divided into sections, usually about a dozen. By beginning with a division down the middle, after this, each section, enclosed in its papery skin, will be able to be lifted and torn loose more easily. There is a stem up the center of the sections, like a mushroom stalk, but tougher. This can be eaten. A special variety of orange, without pits, as an extra growth or nubbin, like half of a tiny orange tucked into its bottom. This nubbin is nearly as bitter as the peel, but it can be eaten too. Don't worry. Some of the sections will have miniature sections embedded in them and clinging as if for life, giving the impression that babies are being hatched. And should you happen to find some of these, you found the sweetest morsels of any. If you prefer to have your orange sliced in half, as some people do, the edges of the peel will abrade the corners of your mouth, making them feel raw as you eat down into the white of the rind, which is the only way to do it, until you can see daylight through the orangey bubbles composing its outside. Your eyes might burn. There is no proper way to eat an orange. If there are pits, they can get in the way, and the slower you eat an orange, the more you'll find your fingers sticking together. And no matter how carefully you eat one or bite into a quarter, juice can always fly or slip from a corner of your mouth. This happens to everyone. Close your eyes to be on the safe side, and for the eruption in your mouth of the slivers of watery meat, which should be broken and rolled fine over your tongue for the essence of orange. And if indeed you have sensed yourself coming down with a cold, there is a chance that you will feel it driven from your head, your nose, and sinuses suddenly opening in the midst of the scent of a peel and eating an orange. And oranges can also be eaten whole, rolled into a spongy mass and punctured with a pencil. If you don't find this offensive, or a knife, and then sucked upon. Then, once the juice is gone, you can disembowel the orange as you wish and eat away its pulpy remains and eat once more into the whitish interior of the peel, which scours the coating from your teeth and makes your numbing lips and the tip of your tongue start to tingle and swell up from behind until, in the light from the windows, shining through an empty glass bowl, you see orange again from the inside. Oh, oranges, solid O's, light from afar in the midst of the freeze, and not unlike that unspherical fruit which first went from Eve to Adam, and from there, to abbreviate matters, to my brother and me. Mom, we think we're getting a cold. You mean you want an orange. This is difficult to answer or dispute or even to acknowledge, finally with a fullness that the subject deserves and that each orange bears without its own makeup into this hard-edged yet insubstantial, incomplete, cold, wintry world.
Listening in and speaking out. He rocked, I reeled. By Tama Janowitz. In high school, I took a remedial English class. Maybe it wasn't remedial exactly, but without my knowing it,
I had signed up for some kind of English class for juvenile delinquents. Well, it wasn't supposed to be a class for juvenile delinquents. But somehow, everybody but me knew that that was who it was for. Maybe it was listed in the course catalog as being for those students in the commercial program, the general program. Whatever it was called to distinguish it from the academic pre-college preparation program. But anyway, on the first day I figured out who this course was directed at. The students were surly and wore leather jackets, and the girls all had shag hairdos as opposed to straight and ironed, which was how the nice girls wore their hair. The juvenile delinquent classes generally meant angry teachers and angry students who never read the books assigned and never spoke in class, which was no wonder because the teacher was generally contemptuous and sneering. But this class ended up being different. The main thing was that the teacher, Mr. Paul Steele, didn't seem to know he was teaching students who weren't supposed to be able to learn. He assigned the books by Sherwood Anderson, by Hemingway, by Melville, and somehow by the due date, everyone had read them and was willing to talk about them. Mr. Steele was a little distracted, a little dreamy, and most excellent. It was one of the few times up until that age I had a teacher who spoke to me and the rest of the class with the honesty of one adult talking to others, without pretense or condescension. There was no wrong or right, just discussion. In college, I had another great course, in geology, a subject for which I had no interest. Once again, I had signed up for something that looked easy, a course to fulfill the science requirement. But this guy, I believe his name was Professor Sand, an apt name for a geology teacher, was so excited and in love with rocks, with everything pertaining to the formation of the earth, that to this day, rocks and everything pertaining to the formation of the earth still get me excited. I remember another teacher, in graduate school, Francine Duplessis Gray, who taught a course called Religion and Literature, another subject in which I had no interest. But the way she spoke was so beautiful, in an accent slightly French-tinged. And because she was so interested in her topic, the students became interested, and her seminars were alive and full of argument. Of course, I had many other fine teachers along the way, but the ones who stand out in my mind were those who were most enthusiastic about what they were teaching. Many subjects in which I initially thought I was interested were totally destroyed for me by the teacher's dry, aloof, pompous, disengaged way of speaking. But when the teacher was as excited about the topic as if he or she was still a little kid, rushing in from the yard to tell a story, that was when the subject became alive for me.